history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there, amazing stories, remarkable stories, just waiting to be told. We'll just take a little time to ask some questions and listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We really want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Fresno, California, at the beautiful Veterans Home of California with 100-year-old Jane Boot. When did you turn 100, Jane?
December 25th.
You've been a Christmas baby for 100 years.
Yes.
How did you feel about that when you were young?
Well, the problem is, I never got any birthday presents because it was Christmas and everybody got Christmas presents. So I kind of got lost in the shuffle.
And you were the youngest of five kids, so you were already at the bottom of that totem pole.
Right.
How about this Christmas, though? Did number 100 work out okay for you?
It worked out fine. Really had a nice party.
Yeah, you even had a congressman here, I think, to do some special things for you?
Yes, they gave me a plaque, you know, all the stuff.
Well, people are going to hear you, and I don't know if they're going to believe you're 100. And I know they wouldn't believe it watching you walk around here at the California Veterans Home either. But I want to talk about way back when you were that little girl growing up in Erie, Pennsylvania. What was life like there in the 20s and 30s?
Oh, my. Well, we were all poor. But my mother, once we were grown, my mother said to me, "Did you ever think you were poor when you were young?" And I said, "No, everybody was poor." What was poor? But we certainly didn't have much money. Most of the dads worked, like, they almost all worked for General Electric in that area of Erie. But they put them on just part-time, so at least everybody had something. So that it wasn't too bad, but you knew that you didn't get things as rapidly as you did later. Yes, we knew we were deprived.
What about as the youngest child in a family of seven? You're the baby girl. Do you remember having some hopes and dreams of someday, here's what I want to do with my life?
I think my mother prejudiced me. She always wanted to be a nurse. So I think when I was born, she thought she could have her vision realized through me because she couldn't do it. So I think she kept telling me all my young life that's what I wanted to be, because I never remember being wanting to be anything else. So I from very, very young, planned to be a nurse.
And that's what you would do in World War II. People have heard quite a few times probably that 16 million Americans were in uniform during World War II. Maybe they don't hear so much about the fact that 300,000 of them were women in uniform during World War II, and you were one of those. But if I'm doing the math here, 100 years old, you were probably becoming a nurse before the war started, right?
Yes.
So you got done with high school, and where'd you go?
I went to Pittsburgh to Allegheny General Hospital, went through their three-year nurses training. That's when they still had three-year nurses training. And then from there, I went into service.
You know, I'm curious, now that I think of it, talk about high school. You know, today, I mean, I have two daughters right now that are teenagers, and the opportunities for young women in high school, I mean, they can play just about any sport they want. They have all these different activities. What about for you as a high schooler in the late 1930s? What kind of opportunities did you have?
Well, first, we lived about as far away from the high school as you could get. We lived within a couple of blocks of the little town of Wesleyville. So we were right on the edge of Erie, and it was difficult for us to be engaged in activities. So I really didn't get into any activities in high school, you know, because we'd have to go on the bus to go to school, and if we stayed after school, you know, we'd probably have to walk home, and that was our distance, a couple miles, so that was too much.
Especially when there's some lake effect snow happening, right?
and a lot of snow to plow through.
Well, I was thinking too. I mean, if that's your situation, you're out of town like that, and you've got four older siblings. Did they do all the chores, or did you have some tough chores that you had to handle as a young lady?
I didn't see I was very favored, but after we were adults, my siblings all said that I was the youngest and I didn't have to do anything. They thought I was very favored, but I didn't feel that way.
What was the toughest chore you had to do around the house?
Probably dry the dishes.
And so you get through high school and you go to nursing school there in Pittsburgh. So your thought was, I'll just be a nurse, work in a hospital and help people heal. Did you find fulfillment in that early?
Yes, I thought just of hospital nursing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how were you enjoying that?
I didn't really care much for it. I didn't care that much for that. I guess that's why I went in the service. But of course, when we finished nurses training, they were looking for nurses in the service all the time. So they practically were at the door waiting for us.
Well, everyone I've interviewed over the years who was alive during this time period seems to remember something about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember that day and how you found out the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Oh, yeah. I was sitting in the dining room. No, I was sitting in the kitchen. There's a little table area right at the end of the kitchen before you went in the dining room. I was sitting there when I heard it on the radio. I heard some usual, we had all a bunch of radio men then that were always getting the news out. And I think that's when I heard it. I think I went in the service in March of 42. I stayed at the hospital in Pittsburgh and worked and then went in the service.
So let's stick with December of 41 here for a moment. So you hear this on the radio, and people all over the country are hearing this on the radio. What was your reaction to that? How did that make you feel, or how stunning was that news?
It was a real surprise to me because when you're in training, it's almost like you get cut off from the world. You know, your own little world is where you are all the time practically, except a few times that you got to go home to visit. So it came as a real surprise to me, Pearl Harbor. But my immediate reaction was, you know, hey, I got to be part of this.
So you didn't wait very long, just a few months later.
Yes.
Was there a recruiting pitch or posters?
Yeah, there were recruiters came around to interview all the nurses graduated because, of course, they were trying to get them to come in the service.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I decided to go in.
Did you think about maybe being a Navy nurse?
No, but if I'd have seen the Navy nurses' hats before I went, I'd have gone in the Navy. They had beautiful hats.
So it was the Army for you.
Yes.
And how did your family feel about that?
I think they were pleased. They seemed to be proud of me.
So March of 42, you joined the Army. What did they do with you? Where'd they send you?
To Iceland.
It's not what I expected to hear.
Iceland. We had, Iceland was in a rather strategic area of the North Atlantic, and the Germans, of course, recognized that right away. And in order to keep the Germans out of Iceland, the British went in. Well, then things got hot for the British, and they had to pull all their troops back to Britain, so the Americans went in that summer. So we got to go to that lovely island.
Did they fly you there, or did you have to take a ship and watch out for the U-boats in the North Atlantic?
We took a ship.
Yeah, what was that like?
And it was terrible. We were all over the place. It took us weeks to get there. And once you got there, of course, you always said the ship before you or the ship after you got torpedoed. But there was a lot of torpedoing, yes, at that time.
Was that kind of nerve-wracking for you?
Yes, it was. I remember one of the guys saying, if we get torpedoed, I'm going to... He pulled out a gun, shoot whoever panics. And I thought, oh boy, I'm not going to panic.
Yeah.
This guy means it too. So I guess he was in charge of security or something. Yeah, it was pretty scary.
It sounds like it. And I'm guessing there weren't a whole lot of women on the ship.
Seven of us.
And how many men?
About 800.
How'd they treat y'all?
Oh, fine. They really looked out for us. Yeah, they took good care of us.
So you get to Iceland. Did you have a chance to explore any of the natural beauty of Iceland while you were there?
Oh, yes. We went all over, except up to the mountains. We didn't go too far in the mountains. But it was quite an interesting place. Although, why anyone would want to live there, I don't know. Just some of those Scandinavians, that's the people who settled Iceland.
So what did they have you doing there in Iceland?
Just taking care of anybody that came in the hospital. They had a hospital about 12 miles out of Reykjavik, and we just manned the hospital. Accidents and sickness, like, you know.
Not going to be battle casualties in that situation.
No battle casualties there. But, of course, there could have been if there had been anyone rescued, but that North Atlantic was cold. You'd have to get out of it awfully fast to not succumb.
Yeah, if you are torpedoed in a situation like that, your chances of survival are very slim.
Right.
And were you getting used to the Army life? Was it difficult to transition to, or did you?
No. I enjoyed being in the Army. I liked it. Yeah, it was a good life.
So what changed? Why did they take you out of Iceland?
Actually, the troops stayed there quite a while, but they reduced them. There was very few there, and they didn't require... In fact, they didn't require any nurses. They didn't even have a hospital. They just flew anything that really needed care back to the U.S. later, so that they only had a corpsman there to treat minor things. But there wasn't any need for us.
But there would be a need for you in Washington, D.C., I understand.
Went to Washington, D.C., got there at the same time as the Doolittle Raiders came back. So nobody noticed me with them around.
Well, you mentioned that, and I want to talk about you treated some of those guys in the hospital.
Yes.
But can you, for those of us who weren't alive, can you help us understand the significance of the Doolittle Raid for all of America, not just for those guys who pulled it off, but what the symbolic value of what they had done was, what it meant to all of you then?
Right. Well, it opened up and made us realize that we could reach the enemy, and that was a big... And I'm sure they realized it, too. So it was of more psychological than anything else.
You arrived the same day as these guys at Walter Reed?
Practically, yeah. It was the first week in July, I think.
So was there some fanfare for them being there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they got a lot of attention.
And what did you have to do there at Walter Reed? What were your responsibilities?
I was a registered nurse on the officer's ward, so I did nursing there.
How many patients did you have to take care of?
Well, it varied, but usually not more than 10 or so. It was not a high disease time, so we didn't have very many patients.
But a couple of her patients had survived that daring one-way mission from the USS Hornet to Tokyo, and she spent a fair amount of time with those Doolittle Raiders. What about General Jimmy Doolittle himself? You're not going to want to miss this. 100-year-old Jane Boot is our guest today. Find photos and a short video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with one of the last of the World War II Army nurses, 100-year-old Jane Boot of Fresno, California. Originally from Erie, Pennsylvania, she grew up near Wesleyville as Jane Kissinger, the youngest of five children. Jane was one of 59,000 women to serve in the Army Nurse Corps during World War II. Her first deployment was to Iceland, of all places, but when we left off, she was at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. In April of 1942, Jimmy Doolittle had led the daring raid on Tokyo, flying the first of 16 B-25 bombers off the deck of the USS Hornet. It was something no one had tried or ever dreamed of before, and with five men aboard each B-25, there were 80 men total, embarking on what they knew would be a one-way mission. 77 of them would survive. Three men were executed after being captured by the Japanese army in China. Another crew landed in the Soviet Union and was held captive for a year before finally being released. And some of those who made it fairly quickly back to the United States were in need of medical attention, which is why they ended up in the officers' ward at Walter Reed. So, Jane, you actually helped nurse a couple of those Doolittle Raiders back to health, right?
Yes, Ted Lawson had, of course, Dr. White was with that raid, and he amputated Ted Lawson's leg because it was infected in China. So that he and I think another guy, Thompson, I think his name was, had dislocated shoulders, apparently had gotten, when he landed in the straps from the parachute, dislocated his shoulders, I think. So I think they were the only two patients we got from that.
I don't want to keep digging too hard, and if you're done talking about it, let me know. But I'm interested in this because, you know, now, all of the Doolittle Raiders are gone. The last one died about a year ago, Dick Cole.
Yes.
But in that moment, you're seeing physically what had happened to them, but the reality was it could have been a lot worse for them. That they knew they couldn't go back to the carrier. This was
right.
A one-way mission. They didn't know what was going to happen if they landed somewhere, if they didn't get shot down in those B-25s. Did knowing what they had done, the courage that it required, did that have an effect on you as you're caring for them?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We really honored, and these guys were great.
So you were talking about Ted Lawson. Do you know where he's from? Do you know where he grew up?
Yes, in California.
Right here in Fresno.
Fresno?
Yep.
I remember when his wife died, I was living in San Jose.
Now, as you're caring for these guys, do you talk to them at all about what they'd been through, or did you hear any stories about what it was like to crash land in China and try to get back?
Not really. They did not talk a lot about it. Just that, you know, it was a distressing time for them.
How severe were the injuries they were dealing with?
Yeah, I think we just had those two patients. Of course, we saw the other guys occasionally. They'd come to visit. And one of them had mental troubles, and they couldn't find him for a while. Doolittle spent a lot of time finding that guy because he, you know, didn't know who he was. I guess he finally located him. I remember he was so distressed because he wasn't in uniform. Of course, by that time, he'd probably been through sets of clothes getting where he was. And he ordered new uniforms for him, and even his back pay, he insisted they come and give him his back pay. So I thought that was being very considerate.
Well, the other thing that comes to mind is, I mean, we know that, as you just said, that was more of a symbolic victory. It didn't devastate the enemy militarily, but it proved America can hit Japan. And there was a price that was paid for that hit on Japan, and you were looking at it. I mean, you saw
right. This
guy's life was never going to be the same. Is that, and I have friends that are nurses, that they see traumatic things, I know. As a young woman,
right. To
look at someone who just gave up a piece of himself for everybody else in the country, what kind of effect does that have on you?
Oh, well, I don't know. Of course, I really honored these guys. Mm-hmm. I said it was, you know, I thought I was privileged to take care of them, which proved to be true.
What was your rank at the time?
I was a first lieutenant by then.
Well, the reason I ask is because I understand. You mentioned that some of the other Doolittle Raiders would come visit these guys while they were under your care. And I understand that you tried to kick a private off of the officer's ward before you found out who he really was?
He came on the ward dressed like a buck private. And I had just been assigned to the officer's ward, and I was kind of full of it. And so he was talking to another guy. Anyway, I walked up to them, and I was going to say to him, you know, why are you in this officer's ward? You know, what's your business here? And along came this guy who was a spit and polish, all dressed up in uniform and insignia and everything, calling out to, oh, and then I didn't realize who he was at first. I should have recognized him, but I didn't. I didn't expect to see him, I guess. And anyway, this guy calls out to him, oh, you know, General Doolittle, and I thought, oh, at the end of it, I'll be in Alaska. But he was very nice, put his arm around my shoulder. I was just doing my duty. Very gracious guy. Of course, I got to know him quite well then. He came often to see his boys that he called up.
Well, I guess that gives you a taste into what he must have been dealing with, too, his celebrity during this time.
Yes.
I mean, because when he gets back from that, he's given the Medal of Honor.
Right.
His picture's on the front page of every newspaper. He'd already been famous before the war as an aviator.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he felt he had to be incognito to see those guys, apparently.
Probably.
That's a pretty good claim to fame, Jane. I kicked General Doolittle out of the officer's ward, or at least tried to.
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned that you got to know him quite well. You know, he's someone that a lot has been written about and said about. You saw him in a time where I'm sure his heart was shining through.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that you observed about Jimmy Doolittle?
He was a very humble person, really. He didn't flaunt his status or his claim to fame or anything. Seemed to be very concerned about other people, and especially his boys, and came often at night when he would be out for something else, he'd stop, see them. So I admired him a lot.
Well, I bet you also got a view of what that meant to them to have him there checking on them.
Yes. I think his men all knew that he was their prime concern.
And speaking of Ted Lawson, the plane that he flew that day was called the Ruptured Duck. They have a representation of that in Hawaii. If you go to the Pacific Aviation Museum, they have the Ruptured Duck there. But he then was the person, if I'm remembering right, wrote the book,
right.
30 Seconds Over Tokyo.
Yes.
Which then became a movie. Were you still in the States when that was coming out, or were you already overseas?
Yeah, no, I was, I can't remember where I was, but I remember about that had come out while I was there. Yeah, I was still here.
So that must have been a little surreal to go to the movies and...
And what, yes.
You had a connection to this guy.
Yeah, they did a very good job. It was actually, of course, I think that Ted insisted on being kind of a director in that. He didn't want a lot of false stuff. And they did pretty well until they got to the end, and they just couldn't show a toothless Van Johnson who was playing his part. They just couldn't bring themselves to do that. But he lost all his teeth when he went through that windshield. That was the only part that really wasn't true.
Now that I hear you mentioning that, I guess I should have had you describe for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, since here's a patient you're caring for and you're informed of everything that had happened to him. Can you describe for us, as you understand it, what happened to him at the end of that mission, that one-way mission to Tokyo?
He tried to make the coast, but didn't have enough gas. So that's why he landed on the beach. But beaches aren't very good landing strips. And when he hit the beach land, sand stopped the ship, and it threw him through the windshield, and that's when he lost his teeth.
So you're caring for a guy who's lost all of his teeth and lost one of his legs.
Yep.
What were his spirits like?
Actually, he was in pretty good spirits. His wife came to see him. He didn't want her to come, but Jimmy Doolittle insisted that they bring the wives in. And he got so excited when he saw her, he jumped out of bed and fell flat on his face because he forgot he didn't have a leg.
Wow.
So, but that was true, and I reported that because I saw it.
You saw it happen. All right. So you care for him. He writes the book. It becomes a movie. You see Van Johnson, this big movie star, playing the guy that you've gotten to know. And then the Americans are going to make a landing in Europe. So there's going to be a need for nurses to go overseas. Is that something you had considered, that you might get sent overseas at some point?
Sure. There was always a chance. And it seemed like if you were gone once, they thought, hey, they already know what it's all about. We'll send them again.
So because you'd been to Iceland, they knew you could handle going across to Europe.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
It was a much better crossing. They used the Southern Crossing. It was warmer, and it was a bigger ship.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a much smoother crossing going over to Europe. We landed in Cherbourg.
Uh-huh. How many nurses were with you this time?
This time I think we had almost a full hospital group, which would probably be around 10.
So where did they send you once you landed in France?
We went into Germany to Mainz. I think there were two little towns called Mainz and Worms. Anyway, Mainz and Worms stays in my mind. And that's as far as we got into Germany. And then things were over and we came back.
Uh-huh.
So that was as far as we got into Germany, which was about halfway, I guess, and to the west.
But you'd been in France, maybe Belgium, Luxembourg.
Belgium and Luxembourg.
And then
Germany. Go through those to get to Germany.
Right. And so you're basically following Patton's Third Army as they're capturing territory. The Battle of the Bulge happens. There's a ton of casualties from that.
Right.
And you were caring for some of them?
Yes. Well, Patton was going. He was just trying to go so fast. We couldn't keep up with him.
Mm.
So we finally settled down.
And there were different kinds of hospitals, different degrees or different distances from the front. What kind of hospital
right.
were you working in?
This was what we called an evac hospital. I don't know what they called them in Korea.
Oh, the MASH units?
MASH units, yeah.
Uh-huh.
We called them evac units, and that's exactly what they did. We triaged them and evacuated them either to a general hospital or flew them back to the base. So that's what we did most of the time. So we didn't keep a lot of people there all the time.
Was that a challenging task?
Yes, yes. Because you really, it made a difference whether they got to the right care when they needed it. So it behooved you to really be alert to everything that counted.
And can you give us an idea of the kind of shape these guys were in, the kind of injuries that you were seeing or dealing with or try to save them from?
There seemed to be a number of chest injuries, and arms and legs seemed to get injured, I suppose, because they were trying to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw a lot of that, broken limbs.
And if one of your grandchildren were here right here and said, Grandma, tell us, what was your job at that point? What did you have to do? What was the point of it? How would you describe that, what you were tasked with doing at that point? Was it bringing comfort? Was it just deciding where they were going to go, in which
right.
direction? Can you help us understand what that would have been like? What were the different things you had to be responsible for?
Well, you had to know what injury needed to be seen immediately and what could wait. So this was pretty much, of course, anything bleeding got immediate attention. Otherwise, broken bones, of course, could wait for a while. So it was just you. It was something you just had to, and you got better at it as you did it, getting them to the right place at the right time.
Did it ever feel overwhelming?
Yes. Yeah. And yet other times it was very slow, depending on, of course, what was going on.
But there were some periods where the influx was so great that it was hard to keep up?
Right.
Would you have to work around the clock, or how would they handle that?
Yes, we sometimes worked. Yeah, there were some periods that were very slow, and we, you know, had a really normal time. But others that were so rapid, we worked many hours on, almost till you dropped, actually got to the point where you might make a wrong decision, and then, of course, you knocked off and slept for a while. But we worked sometimes many hours on straight.
So you're so exhausted, you might not even be thinking straight anymore.
Right, and it was time to take a rest.
And right now, it's time for us to take our last break. But there's much more to come with 100-year-old Jane Boot. What else does she remember about those courageous soldiers she cared for in Europe in World War II? Find photos and a short video of Jane online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you'll also find a link to the Veterans Home of California in Fresno, where she now makes her home. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our eye-opening conversation today with 100-year-old Jane Boot, an Army nurse in World War II, who continued in nursing for four decades after the war, retiring from the VA in 1984. As an aside, if you're one of those folks who listens regularly to Hometown Heroes, you may remember another World War II nurse who served in some of the same areas as Jane. It popped into my mind this week because the Colorado Avalanche this week in Denver had 97-year-old Leela Morrison drop the puck for one of their NHL hockey games. You can find some video of that great tribute at the start of their game on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. As for Jane Boot, you heard her explain her first assignment in Iceland and the privilege of caring for a couple of Doolittle Raiders at Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington, D.C., all before she was sent over to Europe following General George S. Patton's Third Army on its march toward Germany. Jane told us how exhausting it could be in their evacuation hospital and described some of the kinds of injuries they dealt with on a daily basis.
How often would you be sent a patient that there was nothing you could do for them?
Oh, yeah, there were times like that. Yeah. Then you just gave as much comfort as you could and as much morphine as you could.
Is there a residual effect of that that wears on you day after day after day?
I can get weepy just thinking of it. Mm. I try to stay away from it.
Well, I'm sorry for pushing on that tenderness,
all right.
And I don't want to take you anywhere you don't want to go. But I am curious, as a young lady, I mean, you're in your early 20s here.
Right.
How did you handle that? Was there something that helped you endure or get through that emotional weight that you're carrying daily?
No, I don't really know. You just kind of rise to the occasion. You do what needs to be done, and sometimes you're glad to be busy because then you don't have time to think. So I was glad for the busy times.
And, I mean, you just told me how hard it was to see guys who their physical condition is such that you just can't save them.
Right.
What about their psychological condition? Did you see a variety with regard to that, of how they were handling the reality of these injuries they'd sustained?
Most of them didn't realize their own condition.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be something that shields the mind because I think they realized they were maybe injured, but I don't think they realized they were dying.
What was the hardest thing you had to do or deal with during that time?
I think just knowing that too many of these young men were dying.
I don't want to put any words in your mouth or suggest something that isn't there, but I'm just curious if you think back on specific situations or patients that you would say exemplified courage or struck you as an example of that courage that others would want to emulate?
Oh, all the guys were great. I think they were more concerned about you if they realized that you were thinking about them and how it made us feel to lose any of them. We had a lot of brave men.
Being an evacuation hospital, you're treating them for just a brief period of time and then sending them on.
Right.
Was that hard to not know what happened to these guys?
No, because I knew they were going to get good care, and as soon as we could get them back to it.
And during these times, I mean, to be an evacuation hospital, that means you're close enough to where the action's happening that you're going to get them before their ultimate destination.
Right.
So there's some danger to that proximity too, isn't there? Did you ever feel that you were in danger? Were there ever bombing raids or anything that came close to where you were living?
Yeah, we had a few bullets through the canvas. It was a little scary, but we were so busy you didn't really have time to think about it. Mm-hmm. You had so much to do, and you just kept at it.
And you said something there that I want to circle back to, so people get the right mental picture here. You said bullets through the canvas. You had canvas because this is an evacuation hospital that has to be mobile. You have to go to where the action is, right?
Right.
So you didn't have four walls around you. Mm-mm. You're just in tents?
Right.
What about when you sleep at night? Where would you sleep at night?
We had tents to sleep in, too.
Uh-huh. Was it hard to sleep?
No, because usually you were so tired, the minute you relaxed, you'd go to sleep because you were so tired.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember one time in, the guys thought it was, they were being so nice to us, they got us cots to sleep on, but you would have been better off on the ground because all that cold air was underneath us. I think that was the coldest night of my life. So we finally talked them into letting us sleep on the ground. It was warmer.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up too, because, here we're talking about the Battle of the Bulge and all the casualties, but so many veterans who survived the Battle of the Bulge have told me, hey, the weather was worse than the enemy. The guys had frozen feet and frozen fingers.
It was one of the coldest seasons that North Europe had had for years.
And you'd grown up in Erie, Pennsylvania, where you get the lake effect snow. So this was worse?
It was worse.
And you didn't have a fire in the corner to put your hands by, huh?
Right.
Do you think back on anything during that time, whether it were other people or something you saw? Was there something that you think enabled you to do the difficult job you were doing on a daily basis?
I think it was my family. My mother, who always said, we never went out of the house, but what she said, remember who you are, which meant you better behave yourself.
And she'd always wanted you to be a nurse.
Yes.
Little did she know you'd be dealing with the price of freedom on a daily basis there. What about the timing of all of this? Did it seem like it was lasting a long time and there was no end in sight? Or could you get a feel for, we're almost there, the end is near?
No, I felt like it was just going to go on and on and on because it was continuous.
No weekend passes to Paris or days away from the hospital or anything?
I got into Paris once.
Uh-huh.
I almost didn't make it, but I did. And, of course, many years later, another nurse and I went back to Europe, like in 77 or along in there, and we thought, hey, it got easier getting into Paris this time.
I guess so. There's another question that I haven't asked you that I guess I have to, because I've talked to so many Purple Heart recipients who spent time in those hospitals in Europe, and to a lot of them, nurses were equivalent to angels.
Yeah.
They were saving their lives. They were the most beautiful women they'd ever seen.
Right.
Any of those guys ever get sweet on you?
Yeah, a lot of them get real attached. But no, I never took care of my husband in a situation like that.
Well, and you said it felt like it was just going on and on and on and on. So when you heard that the Germans had surrendered?
Oh, boy, that was a joyous day.
And you were in Germany by then?
Yes.
So how'd you find that news out?
They came down from commander. I guess they probably sent it out to all of the units. And I remember we stopped. We were going. We had just taken over a monastery and liberated a wine cellar. Oh, that brandy was wonderful. Boy, those monks knew how to make brandy. And we all got zonked. Boy, that brand, it was strong too, but boy, it was smooth going down. So it was easy to drink too much. So I think we all staggered around drunk for a while till it wore off.
Well, and just because the Germans have surrendered doesn't mean there aren't still soldiers who need your care.
Right.
How long did you stay over there before they let you come home?
We had been over there quite a while. So they gave us numbers, I think, and when your number came up, you got to go home. I came back pretty early because I'd been there a while. I was glad to get back too.
What was it like to come back? I mean, you'd been away from home for a long time and didn't know when you were going to get to come back. Did you go back home and see your folks, or what'd you do?
Yeah, I went back. They all thought I was great. Showed me off. Put a big piece in the Erie paper. Guy from the newspaper interviewed me.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it was nice to get back.
Yeah, you live here at the Veterans Home of California, and there are a lot of combat veterans who are in here who are your neighbors. And a lot of them have shared over the years that it was hard to reengage with civilian life when they'd been in a war zone for so long. As a nurse,
right.
What about for you? Were there things that you had to process or to come full circle on or to let go? Was it hard to jump back into life in America?
Yeah, in a way it was, because you felt like these people don't really know what it's like. So it took a little bit to feel at home again.
And you decided to stick with nursing?
Yes. I went to Walter Reed, stayed there for quite a while.
As I understand, you continued to work at VA hospitals until 1984, is that right? What kept you engaged in that way? What did you get out of nursing that produced that lifetime commitment to it?
A satisfaction of caring for someone who needed help.
The time that you spent around all these men who are in such a vulnerable position, they don't know if they're going to live or die. Sometimes you didn't know if they were going to live or die. When you did know, that was a heavier weight. What perspective did that give you on the men who won that war for the Allies, who secured the freedom that we still enjoy all these years later? What should we know today about who they were and what they did?
I guess, some newspaper guy, I think, called them the greatest generation. And they were, I think, because they really were selfless. Those men thought only of other people. It was just our typical American guy, kind of cowboy.
Well, you're part of that generation, too. And I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us.
Thank you.
I know you're only 100, and you got a long way to go. But is there something, as you reflect, that you would say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I felt honored to serve and had the highest regard for all of the men I came in contact with. Really helped give you courage to go on.
And I know you've done a lot in 100 years. Is there anything that you still have on your list that you haven't done yet that you'd like to accomplish?
Seems to me I thought about that the other day, and I don't know whether I come up with an answer yet. I don't think so.
Well, maybe the Navy will let you wear one of those nurse's hats now.
Maybe that Navy will give me one of their nurse's caps. I was going to send my granddaughter out to the clothing stores, and see if she could find a Navy hat for me.
We've got Lemoore Naval Air Station right down the road here.
Oh, good. Well, I'll have her go there.
Well, there's just a couple more things I wanted to ask you about, and if there's anything else you want to add, please feel free. Before you lived at the Veterans Home here in Fresno, you were at the original California Veterans Home in Yountville, up near Napa.
Right.
And while you were there, you took a trip with Honor Flight to go see the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. What was that experience like for you? What'd you get out of it?
Oh, that was great. That's really a fine service. Every veteran should be able to do that. I'm glad they're doing it. It was a thrill to see it and recognize what they've done for veterans.
What were you thinking about when you were at the World War II Memorial, seeing the names of every state and the Pacific and the Atlantic and those gold stars representing 400,000 Americans who didn't come home? What went through your mind when you were taking that all in?
It was very humbling to see that. Kind of made you sad.
Did they take you to the Women's Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery?
Yes. Yeah, that was an experience, too, that I hadn't expected.
Things have changed a lot for women in 75 years, haven't they?
Yes. Women fly combat planes now.
Uh-huh. And when you were serving in the Army as a nurse, there were women flying planes, but they weren't allowed to go overseas and fly combat.
Right.
Just fly them around the states, and some of them died doing that.
Yes.
In light of all that, did you ever feel, especially going to that women's museum, where it tells the story of the WASPs, who I'm talking about there, or the nurses, or the WAVES, or the SPARs, or all the different ways women contributed to the war effort, did you ever get the feeling that maybe you were a trailblazer, that you paved the way a little bit for opportunities women would get later on?
I think so, yes. We're proud to do it.
I mentioned the 100th birthday party they threw for you here at the Veterans Home. The congressman came and congratulated you. I still see your 100 balloons over here. They still have a little air in them. But I was recently at a Fresno State basketball game, and the loudest cheer of the night, it started out as a cheer, and it just kept louder and louder and louder. And when they finally said, "Red Wave, please congratulate Jane Boot," the place went crazy, and it was deafening. And you were sitting there with some ROTC cadets soaking that all in. What kind of moment was that for you?
Oh, that was great. I really enjoyed that. I said to the guy next to me, I said, "This gives me a chance to sit next to young, good-looking guys." He, of course, just laughed.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't think he'd ever had the opportunity to sit next to a 100-year-old World War II nurse before either.
No, I don't think so. I don't think there are very many of us.
No, there really aren't. And in light of that, I guess that's where I'll finish. You know, most of the people listening right now didn't live through World War II. They didn't hear the Pearl Harbor announcement on the radio. They didn't hear FDR talking about it. They didn't hear about the Doolittle Raid or Midway or anything that happened over that intense time of history. What's the most important thing that people today need to understand about that time in our country's history and what really happened?
Well, I think people who were not there should realize that those of us who were there, just people often said, you know, did you think about it? And we said, we didn't have time. You just did what needed to be done and went on. A lot of women that I've talked to said their husbands never talked about their World War II experience. When we went back to Europe on those flights recently, women would say that until they did this, you know, going there with their husband, that then he would talk about having been there. But she said they never talked. And that was a common thing. The guys just, you know, you pick up and go on, you know, rub a little dirt on it and don't make a big deal about it.
When veterans finally are willing to talk about it, the rest of us are so thankful for our newfound perspective. And Jane Boot has certainly added to that perspective today. We're out of time, but thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org.
sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.